ladies and gentlemen. I hope you had a good weekend and a good start to your week so far. Thank you for tuning in today, for being here. This is Red Eyes Radio, an independent, intrepid radio program that inquires into a lot of different subjects that we find to be both interesting but also important. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and we question the direction of my country and the consequent ongoing suicide and restrictions imposed on those questioning it. This has caused us to re-evaluate the pathological altruism that is promoted within our country as the highest virtue. And you can pretty quick realize that this is actually done to ruin and destroy Swedish tradition, heritage, culture, and ultimately the Swedish people itself. This is a violent and wicked strategy that has caused and will continue to cause a lot of harm. Another thing I'd like to mention with some regularity is that we do encourage our audience to think and research for themselves and make up your own mind about what is discussed. We go into both known and unknown territory and discuss a lot of issues that is not only taboo, but also unfortunately discouraged in these times of thought crimes, authoritarianism, and a lot of fear about reality, human nature, and the secret agendas of the elite. We talk with a lot of different people, and we find it very important to discuss the issues that the powers that be is so afraid of us talking about, even to the point where they legislate against it. Today we have a new voice on the program. Kai Murrows is with us. He is a Finnish intellectual and a nationalist activist from Helsinki. He is fairly well known outside of his country due to his book called Revolution and How to Do It in a Modern Society. He studied at the University of Helsinki between 1990 and 1999, majoring in history and Oriental studies. His Master's of Arts thesis was on the gradual change of the Chinese People's Liberation Party from a guerrilla organization to a professional established one. He's made some very thought-provoking videos on issues of revolution, future direction of Europe, and putting emotions such as hate in context. In regards to the question of global collapse, something we've talked quite a lot about on previous shows, we'll be discussing what he predicts is going to happen in Europe specifically. A mix of dystopian views with war over resources between different peoples is something that he sees at the same time as a pan-European national revolution is going to occur due to the developments that are happening right now. This is a different view, one that I think you haven't heard before. I also want to say thanks to Kyle Hunt for helping us to get in touch with Kai as well, by the way. All right, we'll begin to get his take on what is happening in Sweden and Finland first before we move on to Europe. Welcome, Kai Murrows. It's great to have you here. Thank you so much for coming on. It's a delight to have you here. Hope you're doing well today.
I'm doing fine.
Excellent. This is going to be very interesting. You're a very influential thinker, I'd like to say, for what we've seen as a rise of a kind of a pan-European nationalist movement. There's a lot of interesting videos you have out there. Of course, you've written an essay or a book called Revolution and How to Do It in a Modern Society. A lot of things to talk about here, a lot of important issues today. And we're going to kind of get into a little bit on the dynamics between, you know, Sweden and Finland as well and kind of talk about what's happening in our neck of the woods. But maybe it's a way of kind of introducing you a little bit to our audience who might not have heard about you before, Kai. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you got into the topics we're going to address here today.
Well, I'm a fairly uninteresting person in general. I'm just, you know, ordinary. I come from a middle-class family, and obviously I have been a nationalist all my life. Ever since I could walk, I knew that sort of I was raised that way, and living in the 1970s, you immediately realize that that was kind of threat all the socialists and the communists were, and we sort of grew into this sort of more and more radical nationalism over the years.
What do you think? I just wanted to ask you about this anyway, but the winter war. I think it's a very different environment in Finland than it is in Sweden. Despite, you know, we've had our fair share of threats you know, communists, and in terms of the submarines in the Baltic Ocean and all that kind of stuff. But the Winter War, do you think that has helped to shape the Finnish people in a different way as compared to the Swedish people?
Yeah, I think. Not only, of course, Winter War, but then the so-called Continuance War, which we fought from 1941 to 1944, it sort of gave us a certain self-esteem, because we realized that actually Soviets tried to destroy us twice, and on both occasions they completely failed. And at the same time, it sort of makes the nation sort of much more a stronger unit, because we survived this as one, and then all the political problems that we had before sort of dissolved in the war. Obviously, we had communists always, and it wasn't always easy with them. But there was this sense of nationhood anyway. So it sort of national cohesion grows when you're struggling over survival, and it was a bitter school, and I wouldn't wish it to anyone, but. Maybe this is something that the Swedes don't have, and maybe that's one of the reasons why Sweden is today what it is.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we've had a long period without, you know, war. We've been neutral, well, to a certain degree anyway, in many other wars have been fought. I think we haven't had any major conflict in about 200 years, and I think that this has helped to shape a kind of a, well, I call it the disease of neutrality, because we end up saying yes to everybody. And now, mm-hmm. you know, for the first time, we're starting to see some real tangible problems and threat to the peace that we've had within the country for many, many years. And this is largely due to the ethnic and cultural and religious conflicts that we've been, you know, that we've been bringing upon ourselves. We've been, or our elite has done it to us, of course. But how do you view Sweden from the outside and the current state of affairs and everything else? From over there in Finland, Kai.
Yeah, Sweden. It's sort of there's something scary about Sweden. It's sort of like the way I see that you're like lemming, that you are just running across the cliff, and everybody's shouting that stop, don't go there, and Swedes are just sort of happily jumping around and just going toward their destructions. I often feel that you Swedes, you should be sort of just taken to some log cabin in the mountains and tied to a chair and smack you in the face and throw cold water over you and force you to listen to some tapes and you know, that might make you wake from your slumber. It's sort of like an intervention, like you have an alcoholic and you make this intervention that you try to save this person. But yeah, you're right that it's been going on like, well, actually Sweden has been able to enjoy peace more like 300 years, because the last really bad war that Sweden took part in was the Great Northern War. Yeah. And afterwards, all the other wars were sort of very light, and often they actually were fought in Finland. So I think one reason for Sweden being what it is that you're suffering from a thing called survivor's guilt. I mean, because things have been going so well for so long anyway.
Yeah.
So this sort of sense comes that the Swedes think that they can make amends with God if they turn the society into absolute shit, because things have been going too well for too long, and now it's time that we soil ourselves or something. Maybe something like that.
What do you think is at the root of that, though, if we try to go a little bit deeper in that question and why we're allowing a lot of the things that are occurring to our society? I think there's something to the idea of we feel good about ourselves by feeling bad about who we are really, and despite the fact that we've stayed out to a large degree of things like, you know, colonialism, like the academics of the day is trying to blame Europeans on, and therefore they should kind of accept you know, mass immigration into their countries, etc., all that kind of stuff. We've been fairly stayed out of that kind of situation, but yet despite that, it's kind of like that we owe something to all the other nations around the world or something. I'm not sure. Is there a psychological factor here, do you think?
You're absolutely right. The Swedes have this massive guilt complex over things that they had nothing to do with. Like the Swedes have a huge guilt complex over Second World War, even though you weren't even taking part. And that's the really weird thing, that of all the people on the planet, Swedes are like suffering because of slavery and everything sort of reflects the Swedes, and Swedes feel bad about it. But maybe it's also some kind of masochism that you feel good about feeling bad. I guess one major reason for Swedes being what they are is that it's sort of you are very serious Protestants. Even when you are atheists, you are sort of culturally you are very serious Protestants. And when somebody says to you that, now this is the right thing to do, you take it literally, and no matter, you just don't listen to reason, you're sort of very obedient people, and that's the wonderful thing about you, but it's also now definitely turning against you.
Well, it's kind of a run amok, I don't know what to call it, progressivism, liberalism. It's an extreme situation, really, which is so interesting, because we've been told that we're very much kind of in the, we're like the medium, middle of the road kind of things, shouldn't go too much in this direction or the other direction. But
yeah, logom people.
Logom, exactly, you know the word. But it's an extreme situation, though, that has arisen in Sweden now, where we have, it's expected, if the current asylum laws continue and whatnot, we have an expected 1 million immigrants coming into Sweden in the next 5 years. And already we cannot house these people. We cannot take care of them. Our system is going down the drain. Why are they not waking up to the reality of the situation, that this is unsustainable?
Yeah, it's really weird. It's sort of cohesion also in Sweden, or sort of culture that you just have to follow the sort of official line or the official values, and there's no sort of rebelling against them. But I guess that is being very sort of obedient and Protestant. It comes from that you are very disciplined people, and once you've been told that this is the thing to do, then no buts about it. Then you just follow what you've been told to do, and it's almost like in North Korea, which is quite scary.
Yeah, well, that opens up an interesting question, though, because of course, if this goes in the wrong direction, and if public opinion can be swayed in a different direction, there would be a different tune that would be singing there. Let's get to that a little bit later here, but it seems like we want to be world champions in asylum seekers. I mean, as a small country as we are. Despite our small population numbers and whatnot, we've taken in even more immigrants than Germany, for example, which is they're about 80 million strong, and we're about probably 8 million native Swedes.
Yeah.
And despite that, we've taken in more people. What kind of conditions are we creating here for ourselves if we look at this realistically, Kai, and look at what we've seen already with the rise of the riots and everything else, and how is this going to play out in the future? What are we bringing upon ourselves? And let's kind of try to address this to people who think that this is going to be wonderful. It's a great kind of rainbow nation that will appear here, and it's going to be peace and love, right?
Yeah, actually, a moment ago, a friend of mine called me, and he'd been listening to radio, Finnish radio, and there was this interview. A Finnish guy called Asko Salberg was interviewed, and I guess he's some sort of writer or something. But anyway, he's been living in Sweden for 20 years, and he said that this idea of folkhemmet, people's home or whatever, is a wonderful, beautiful idea, but it has been totally destroyed, because Sweden is full of, there are hundreds of thousands of people who hate Swedes, who have absolutely no idea, who don't consider themselves to be Swedes, and Mr. Salberg said that it's absolutely and utterly certain that this will end in a total disaster, and he's been living in Sweden for 20 years, and nothing surprising in that. I mean, that's what we've been talking about for years, that this will at a certain point come to a total disaster. Eventually, of course, Swedes will wake up. I mean, it will happen at some point, definitely. But it's quite interesting to see how long it will take. I mean, let's say that you'll get about 1 million immigrants within the next 5 years. So maybe after next elections, the number of the good Swedes is not anymore 87%, but maybe it's something like 70 or 60%.
Yeah.
So after that, maybe you need another cool 1 million or 2 million immigrants, and then maybe it will be something like 50-50. But the trend is a friend. I mean, we are going in the right direction, but Swedes are stubborn people. So maybe even 1 million extra immigrants will not change it more than maybe perhaps like 60% will come to the census or something. Yeah, but of course, in the end, it's going to be, this will lead to social collapse and sort of ethnic civil war. I always say that Western Europe, Sweden included, definitely is going to be like Yugoslavia in the 90s. Yeah. And everything that goes with it, it's going to be sort of combination of Northern Ireland and Yugoslavia. You will have these armed neighborhoods where people take up arms and start defending themselves against the all sorts of criminal gangs and immigrant aggression, and afterwards it will lead to a total disintegration of the state, which then will lead to some sort of nationalist takeover, which will then lead to some sort of, let's say, purges. So it will be something, it will be just as chaotic, as brutal as the aftermath of the Second World War. It's going to be something that's very difficult to understand, that how a civilized society can blow up so totally. But I guess that's what we need in the end, because otherwise we are like in Finland, we say just we are hanging in the loose noose. You know, you are not, you know whether you are choking or not. But so things will be resolved the absolute worst way.
Yeah, I want to get into the intricacies of that here as we go along. But how, if you could put a timeline, I mean, it's impossible to say. I guess to a certain degree, it depends. There's so many variables here and whatnot, but. I guess the point being we've seen small inclinations of this already within Europe and the way that this is starting to happen. And despite this, everything is just kind of chugging along as usual, despite there being polls made and people are, they understand the multiculturalism has failed. We even had some of our, you know, leaders within Europe talk about this too, from Cameron to Merkel and Sarkozy in France and whatnot. They've publicly talked about this. Yet nothing is changing. So what is driving this behind this issue? Is it the political elite that are doing this to the European population, or what is the driving force here?
The driving force is eventually it's capitalism and the political elite from right to left, because of course even the radical left is in this. So basically it's capitalism and. You are right. The fact that certain politicians are already saying that multiculturalism doesn't work, it's a very encouraging sign, because one of the necessary prerequisites for revolution is always that the moment comes when the elite loses its confidence. There's a sort of sense that this is not working out. And then they... That's absolutely. I mean, like in the former DDR, that the last night before the wall collapsed, when the Politburo was there, those guys were talking about what should we do? Shall we order the army to shoot people or what? And they just, you know, lost it. They didn't have the courage then, you know, to send the army to kill people. And then when the people were asked, okay, that's. Do they open the wall and can we go to the west? And say, that's okay, fine. And then overnight the whole state disappeared. So it's sort of when the elite loses its confidence, that's absolutely vital. And because this is a sort of a chaotic system, it means that there's an enormous pressure behind the scenes, and you just can't tell when it explodes. But when it explodes, it's devastating, and that it will then resolve things, matters for good. But you know, you know that it's coming, but you just can't pinpoint the exact time. It may come tomorrow, yeah. It may come next January, but when the moment comes, you realize it, and it starts from very, there's something very little, you know, something very small is happening. And then it's just, you know, it's like the dominoes falling, and there's no stopping.
Yeah, it's a very bizarre situation. I mean, if we look at Europe from a historical perspective, it's nations that have grown out of struggle and blood and tremendous warfare in some cases. And I just don't understand how anybody can perceive that it's realistic to think that this would just somehow kind of go away as well. That at some point, Europeans are going to say we've had enough, right? We don't want to hand over our country. We don't want to lose the thing that our ancestors fought for. In some cases, we've talking about thousands of generations of people who've been part of the makeup of Europe. It's part of us. It's in us in that regard. Do you really think the politician thinks that just with education and just with, you know, kind of applying the right type of, I guess, propaganda and education, that they can kind of breed this out of people? Or how do you think they view this?
I think that the politicians are, at the moment, at least the dumbest ones, they are actually quite confident that it's exactly what they can do, because it has worked so well for so long. So obviously there's no reason why they shouldn't assume that things are going to remain as they are. It's always easier to think that nothing changes than to accept that it's something terrible will happen. So this sort of propaganda, it has worked perfectly well for like 40, 50 years. And if you are in the elite, and so there's no reason for you to think that, that you know, things will go on as they have gone so far. There is, of course, the sort of, I've noticed this sort of idea floating about that even though every conflict on the planet is an ethnic conflict, is a conflict over territory, we have this sort of idea that Western Europeans in particular are sort of post that, sort of post-national, post-tribal, post ethnic,
mm-hmm, yeah.
And that's why when we see, you know, Africans can slaughter each other over some piece of rock, but at the same time we believe that Swedes, Finns, Germans, Brits would never ever do anything such, that we are sort of left all that behind, and but it's because we are living in this weird leftist liberal vacuum, so it's easy to get these really strange ideas. I mean, before the French Revolution, the elite said that, you know, God gave us the land, you know, the aristocracy and the clergy, and they had it really difficult to understand that the peasants wanted freedom and they wanted land, and they thought that, how they dare to demand such things, because all this comes from God, read the Bible.
Yeah.
But in the end, it just wasn't enough, and then you had the revolution. So it happens today as well, or in the future, that the powers that be, and especially the intellectuals and the cultured people, they will be very surprised. How dare they demand these things? How dare they demand that there should be a Swedish nation, and Swedes should be able to walk in peace in their own streets? And I mean, this is total fascism, they will cry. And
yeah.
Well, it doesn't help them anymore.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary. Exactly. It's let's talk about revolution a little bit. Then this is obviously something that has been attributed to, I guess, a more, not always, as you said, there's different variations of this in history, but in recent time, in more modern times, this has been attributed to something which is more coming from a left perspective of being rebellious and going against the, you know, establishment, etc. But now it's like it's a counter-revolution occurring to a certain extent, and you've written about this quite extensively. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit and what it takes in modern society today to pull this off. What is necessary to, because ultimately I guess this is a revolution of the people, and it's of the mind rather. It's an attitude towards the world where this lies. It's not something that I think can be imposed by others in some kind of way, you know, with force, let's say, initially at least. It's something that has to occur within people, an understanding about reality and about what kind of situation we're living in, who is ruling us, etc. What would you say about that, and how to pull off a revolution in modern society? What would it take?
Well, my theory that my book is based on is that basically, the Western industrial societies will simply disintegrate, so that the collapse of economy and obviously the ethnic disintegration will cause that the society will simply sort of end itself. Like in Finland, because of which has to have, you know, tight budgets and all, you can see all the time that the state is sort of shutting down. And at the same time, the sort of mass immigration to Europe is creating this sort of violent anti-white counter society. So we are in a situation that the state shuts it down, and at the same time very dangerous elements are ruling in the streets. So we don't have to topple the state, because the state is already doing it for us. What we have to do is take over this stateless chaos and recreate a nation state. And so in that respect, the most important task is done by our enemies.
Right. So it's about creating a nation state that once again is for us, because it seems like the state apparatus has now circumvented the very people, at least in the Western world, that are living within it and that is even funding it to a certain degree. We're not protected under hate speech laws. There are certain privileges that are earned to people who are, for example, not citizens, etc. While if you're a citizen and if your ancestry have been part of building up the nation, it's like you've been pushed out. You're now left outside of that, which is just incredible. How can this even occur?
Yeah, it's interesting, especially in Sweden. I would say that all the left wing radical violence against Sverigedemokraterna and other nationalists is based on the sort of the idea that they are doing the dirty work for the government. So that whenever some atrocities happen, it's sort of that the government and the state apparatus is like not wink wink, well done. And when there's immigrant violence, it's always the same that Swedes, you know, it's so weird. I mean, this is so strange. Sweden seems to be the sort of the superpower of rapes at the moment, like
yes.
More rapes per capita than in anywhere else. So what are the Swedes actually doing to fight these rapes? Well, there's the idea that you start basically castrating the Swedish males, emasculating them, effeminizing them, like
yeah.
the fact that you don't use han or hun like he or she anymore, but hen. How ironic, hen,
yeah.
like
yeah.
that bird. Anyway, so this sort of so this is the response.
It's idiotic, you know. But at the same time, this is not a. It's they're trying to blame. That all this—it's the Swedish males' problems, right? It's the patriarchy.
Exactly.
The feminists have very much turned against their own. This is a very divisive issue that have created rifts within Swedish society and ultimately within the family core, core unit. But at the same time, it's a protection of, let's say, other ethnicities and everything else. And the same measures are not kind of applied there in that regard. So it's a complete. Just disillusionment, and they've been really successful in completely, you know, shattering the society. What do you think the response to this is going to be then? Because it's obvious already that a lot of people are beginning to get sick and tired of the political correctness about these strategies that are used against them. I think the evidence of this is in the recent election that we had in Sweden, where we had about 12.9% voting for the Swedish Democrats have become the third largest party. And at the same time, of course, the opposition to this they're begging the rest of the world for forgiveness. They were asking on social media networks a day of mourning that everyone dresses in black, because it's so horrible that we have some kind of resistance movement within Sweden where they want to preserve the country and their tradition and heritage, and they want to have a country for the Swedish people again. So what is the response to this going to be, and do you expect to see more and more people coming over to that side who get sick and fed up with the liberal government and their strategies against the Swedish people?
Yeah, that's how it goes. But the scary thing is that once then this blows off, we are going to witness such an explosion of utter hate and sort of, I mean, it will get out of hand, and it's going to be so brutal that after everything sort of explodes, this tension, these humiliations that have been going on for decades, there's going to be a sort of tornado of hatred. It's very difficult to even imagine how terrible our people can get when they finally just lose it.
Right, yeah.
But I think in the end, psychologically, we need that. It's sort of like catharsis, sort of
yeah.
purifying hatred. And once you let out all the steam, then you feel a whole lot better, even though I can imagine how our societies will look after that. But anyway, so you have to pay the blood with blood. And so the balancing of, it's a psychologically Europeans need this sort of purifying, purging hatred to be released.
It's interesting that, of course, we have a situation here where our stagnation, to a certain degree, will be spawned due to the conflicts that you've been talking about and that you see in the future for Europe specifically, but I guess all around in the Western world, really. But you've been talking quite a bit about not only violence but also hate, that it's something specifically unique to humans, and that it's something that we don't see, as far as we understand it anyway, in the rest of the animal kingdom, etc. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Some people, of course, have been programmed to such a large extent to hate, which is funny, but kind of resent it for what it represents and whatnot. But how is hate a positive aspect in regards to what we're talking about here?
Yeah, well, first of all, obviously everybody, they are afraid of hate, because if you realize that you hate and you accept that, okay, I hate and I have a very good reason, well, that is very sort of subversive step. You realize that there's something wrong with this society, because now we shouldn't hate because there's nothing wrong with our societies, except maybe we are somehow wrong, but the society is perfect. So that's why, because people are angry. But if you don't acknowledge yourself that you are angry and that you are full of hate, you just feel that you're sort of, there's something wrong with me, even though there's nothing wrong with you. There's something very much wrong with the society. So once you sort of realize that you have every right to be angry, you have every right to hate, that hate becomes a revolutionary force. And that's why all these hate laws, I perfectly understand their function, because this is the one thing they fear, and they know that they cannot, in the end, they cannot control. So once the day comes when, ordering Swedes shout that I'm mad as hell and I have every right to be mad, then things will change.
Well, exactly. It's interesting that they have that approach. They've tried to make it morally unacceptable, and hopefully they think that this is going to be enough to kind of prevent that an outrage against the system from happening. But again, I think ultimately this is a war on human nature, and we've talked with other guests about this before, like Frank Salter and others that have studied behavioral biology and physiology and all these kinds of aspects, that it's very much that the political environment we're living in is very much anti human nature, and ultimately this is not something that they're going to be able to hold back, and that's where I think that they are failing in their strategies. And actually quite a poor strategy, unless, of course, their objective is to create chaos and violence. And I mean, other people have spoken about this, Kai, from the point of view that they're trying to enforce even more control from the point of view of the state apparatus to even more, get us to be under control, basically. And if we see more violence on the streets, if we see more rise of conflict, they are going to, militarize the police further. We're going to get more surveillance. There's going to be really terrible conditions, perhaps, where even our countries will be broken up in different sectors and will be, checkpoints at certain areas. What's the potentiality that we'll see something like that, a kind of a response to the surge of violence?
Well, yeah, I admit that we are getting in that direction, but in the end, I mean, let's face it, Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc collapsed. So what chances are there even for this soft Western liberal totalitarianism? There are no chances, but I understand that we are getting there in that direction, but in the end, it's like simply the collapse of the economy. I mean, the police doesn't do anything unless you pay them, but since we are, and in Finland, like, there are less and less police, so in sort of way, I mean, they are also, everything is based on money, and if the economy based on money disintegrates, well, then there's nobody paying the wages for police officers, and so everything eventually collapses. So if Soviet Union fell, this will fall as well. But it's true that we are actually the powers that be, they are sort of declared war on biology. They want to overcome biology because they understand that because since everything eventually is biological, so even our national revolution is a biological revolution, so that's why they have to fight against it. And emasculating men is one way of doing it, and I bet they would actually physically castrate all newborn boys if they could.
Yeah.
But eventually, obviously, that will fail, because you can fight nature only so long, and
yeah,
then it sort of backfires.
Right.
But we have to remember that people who are behind this, you know, they come from the universities, and if there is a one place which is the furthest away from rational world, ordinary world, it's the university. These are sort of eunuchs and sort of drones, these people. So and the idea of, like, with many middle-aged social democrat fat, plum social democratic women is the idea that every male, if you just manage to scratch the surface, you realize that inside every male there is this fat or plum social democratic hag. And it's very difficult for them to understand that, my God, these boys actually, they can be wild, and they can do, they are normal human beings with, you know, they play war in the forests and do stuff. And they are not those middle-aged fat women. They are not Mona Salino or Gudrun Schumann, but they are men.
Right. Well, it's a good point. I mean, we've been in a state of warrior for countless of years and generations, as compared to the disease of modernity and the way that we've been kind of held back in place. And what you're talking about, it's at some point that this is going to break out again. You can't hold back either genetics or biology, and when the threat around you becomes so extensive, then you'll begin to see certain interesting things occur as a response to this. So a revolution ultimately then, as you said, kind of thing, kind of hinges on, first of all, an economic collapse, really. Is that correct?
Yeah. It always begins with economy.
And we've seen this in the past in other countries, of course, in terms of how the economic environment completely, fell out through under people's feet. They didn't have an ability to get a job, etc. And that's when you begin to see organization. I would guess, though, that this is something that potentially might not occur, you know, at the same time in every single country. Unless, of course, it depends on we know that the economic system is very much tied in now. It's very much, you know, World Bank run, IMF. We have central banks all over the world, etc. But I would think that, let's say, in a country like Sweden, the kind of violence that we're talking about is something that would occur sooner than it is in Finland, due to the fact that immigration is not as bad. Correct? Would this be something that the rest of the world would witness, see happening in Sweden, and then this would spread? Or how do you think that will play out, Kai?
Well, of course, the economic sort of collapse is going to happen fairly quickly all over the world, because the whole system is so tangled. But it's true that the massive violence, even before the actual economic collapse, may start earlier, let's say in Sweden, because the situation economically is so, ethnically is so difficult, and of course totally different from Finland. So there will be times that maybe the rest of the world will be just wondering how this can happen when Sweden is engulfed in sort of massive riots. But so far, even when there has been massive riots, they haven't yet changed the system. So I would say, I'm Marxist enough to say that economy is really, really the important. It's the most important part of the game. However, even before there is a collapse, we have to see that the economic and social and ethnic pressure is sort of creating its cultural ramifications. So already now we can see that this sort of ethnic European identity and thinking sort of a subculture is spreading. So it's already there in the air. So the pressure and its results can be seen already in the culture. So when the change comes, I would say that the European pan-European nationalist culture is already well underway.
Yeah, exactly. I want to talk about that a little bit later here, in terms of a kind of a modern European nationalist movement and whatnot. But Tell us first, how are things in Finland for those people who don't know? If we compare, we've talked about Sweden a little bit, so people, and we've talked about Sweden quite a bit on this program too, so I think our listenership have a pretty good idea about what's occurring and kind of how bad it is, and also kind of some of the lies with the prosperity models and everything else that you know, these countries get ranked among the highest always on happiness index and whatnot. And education-wise, of course, Finland, we know even officially, is much better. But do you have a nationalist movement there? How strong is that? What's the climate like in terms of immigration in Finland?
Well, of course, we have True Finns, which is sort of populist party officially, but in reality, it's of course a nationalist movement. But it's sort of, once it calls itself a populist movement and denies and denounces all sorts of nationalism, it's sort of okay. But everybody is then worried because they have this sort of nationalist wing. But I would say that the rank and file of True Finns are basically just nationalists. But on the other hand, I don't think there's been sort of, people may consider that we haven't had a need for sort of nationalist party because the ethnic situation has been so much better in Finland until these days. And even though there are obviously more immigrants coming to Finland than before, but even then, what makes things easier is that actually a lot of them are Russians and Estonians, so they are white people, and it's easier for them to integrate into the system without even us noticing anything. But when we have then this sort of non-European immigration in certain areas, with all the problems that you have, obviously we also have. So in that respect, there is nothing new, but the numbers are so much smaller. They have been so much smaller, so that's why the situation has remained fairly good.
Do you think that we'll see, I don't know, maybe we already do see that people, I guess, fleeing from the conditions of Sweden, let's say to Finland or Denmark, where I believe things are a little bit better still. I mean, we've certainly had, I read a report a couple of months ago about it was as many people leaving Sweden today as there was during the height of the migration over to the Americas, actually, over to the United States. And I believe that I know that there's a certain percentage of immigrations or asylum seekers that come in that choose not to stay. And I believe that those are included in that statistics. But nonetheless, it's apparently record numbers of people leaving Sweden. And that's also something that would completely kind of undermine, I guess, to a certain extent, what you're talking about. If those people who could be capable of trying to preserve national heritage and identity are leaving and taking off. Is there a chance that it will be kind of hollowed out to a certain extent and you'll just kind of be left with those who are compliant with what's happening right now?
Well, if this development could go on sort of in long periods of time without any interruptions, you are right, but you know, the plot thickens as we speak, so the system will merely run out of time. So I don't think Sweden is not going to hollow out, but yeah, you're right. If there was like system had like 100 or 200 years time, then it might do that.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the modern European nationalist movement as opposed to how that looks, as opposed to the kind of more segregated kind of ethnic nationalism that we have, at least in Europe. I think it's different in America to a certain extent because there you already kind of have a hodgepodge of Europeans already, and they have an American, stance, you know, that's how they identify them as such. But in Europe, we've had many divisions. You know, you've seen yourself as German or as Finnish or Swedish or Spanish or what have you. But when I've heard you speak, you're kind of talking about how those barriers, those lines will begin to disintegrate to a certain extent and something new will kind of rise up from that. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, that's the main reason why I'm so optimistic that so far nationalism in Europe was always that, you know, Germans and French killing each other, Russians and Poles, everybody, the French and the British, all that. Nations have been struggling against each other, and this was perfectly sort of okay because Europeans seem to be on top of the global food chain. So Europeans really had no other enemies, but other Europeans. And this was not a problem. Obviously, the casualties were terrible, but sort of Europe fighting, Europeans, even when they were fighting amongst themselves, they actually could conquer the planet. And the fratricidal wars in Europe sort of made European nation states very effective because they had to fight against their neighbors. And once they went overseas, and then they could actually create massive empires. But anyway, the thing why things, I'm so optimistic is that now when Europeans are facing this common enemy, it sort of welds us Europeans together because this sort of near-death experience always brings people together. And now we are Europeans, we are experiencing a near, this is our near-death experience. And sort of it becomes pointless to wallow in the wars of the past and who did what to whom and all that. And that's why of all the possible things, this is the best time because now when we are, now when the sort of new nationalism emerges in Europe, it's nationalism that will include all Europeans as one powerful family. And it's not going to be like it was in the past, this petty chauvinism. We are getting past of the petty chauvinism, and we are getting something, European nationalism, which is also sort of socially progressive. Because it's always said that, you know, nationalists, they are sort of just lackeys of capitalists, and it's just some sort of reactionary right-wing stuff. But we are going to have a pan-European nationalism that embraces and includes all Europeans, and at the same time, it's going to be socially and economically progressive. And it's going to, that's why it's going to be absolute dynamite.
So the European Union, in my opinion, is very anti-European, really. But you're talking about something which kind of supplants that, or maybe even to a certain extent using the infrastructure of what has been created with the European Union, but kind of transcending that and turning it into a pro-European movement. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, but on the other hand, I must make this absolutely clear that I do not believe in sort of centralized Europe.
Sure.
That would be a disaster. That will never work. So I want, Europe has to be a sort of, I want to see a global confederation of white nations. And Europe should be better when you have absolutely sovereign national nation states and even sort of these regions where people can preserve their own local culture within the nation state. So no centralized imperial structures. That would be absolute disaster. But yeah, we can still cooperate. We can still become stronger and more decisive when we defend our interests globally. But we don't need this sort of European Union-like system. That would be the worst mistake anyone could do, this think that we could create some sort of nationalist, centralized European state.
Gotcha, definitely. Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about there in terms of a kind of an agreeance between people and an assistance that exists there without the kind of the bureaucratic, centralized governmental structure that we've seen in the European Union. And as we kind of clarified, that's something that actually been used against us, and consequently we've lost national sovereignty due to the European Union, and they've been completely just running over many, many nations and countries here. But we have much more to talk about, Kai. There are so many more questions I want to ask you about in terms of your philosophy, I guess, to a certain extent, your ideas and everything else, your thoughts. But let's just give out some of the details for people. Where is your book available for those who want to read it? I don't know if you have it for sale, if it's available for free on the website. Give us the details so people can reach out and find more of your material, Kai.
Well, everything that I've written is on my website and in the internet. So the book that I published 13 years ago, it was just in Finland as a paperback. It was in Finnish, and it's been sold out years ago. So everything that I have is in the internet. It's been translated into French and was it Lithuanian and Romanian, various European languages, but those people are selling them, those copies, in their own countries. But everything I have, everything I've created, it's in the internet.
Very good. We're going to have the website for that up for you guys as well, listening. The book's called Revolution and How to Do It in a Modern Society. And we're going to have the links up. So check on the program page there for the full URL and everything else. But, yeah, much more to talk about. Stay with us, Kai. We'll take a short break right here, and then we'll be right back with more. We continue in our second hour. We get into the hopelessness that comes with realizing that our people are targeted and disrupted intentionally with mass immigration. There's also the issue of resource depletion, overpopulation, and our governments have given up on us and that we are no longer protected in our own countries in the same way as minority groups are. These are, of course, global majorities too, by the way. Kai talks about why, despite all this, he is still optimistic after all. We discuss strength in collectivism and his views on socialism. Some surprises there, perhaps. We juxtapose this with the European and Western tradition as being more inclined towards individualism. We discuss pan-European nationalism and that more and more people are seeking structure, strength, and direction in a time of decadence, moral relativism, and emptiness that comes with modernity. We discuss how to appeal to people and the control of culture, Christianity, and more. Tune in at redicemembers.com for the second hour. Subscribe and get access to a lot more programs on a wide variety of topics. You'll find a lot of different voices and perspectives that we hope you find challenging and engaging. Hey, by the way, before we proceed, iPad and iPhone users might experience some issues since the last update to iOS 8 that Apple recently released. There might be issues with you playing the program on the member site in your internet browser, you know, using our player or just clicking on the download links. We are looking into this right now, but as a way around it, please use a podcast app to subscribe to the RSS members feeds. This is really the easiest and quickest way to get the program anyway. So if you're on an iPhone or an iPad, go to the FAQ on redicemembers.com and just click on iPhone or iPad to get the instructions on how to do this. It's very quick. It's very easy. There are free podcast apps. There are some that are available for a low cost as well. So, and we have a few different recommendations there for you to circumvent and solve this issue until we can figure out why iOS 8 is giving us some issues. We have upcoming, by the way, on the program, Kevin MacDonald, Dennis Fetcho, John Rappaport, Michael Hoffman, John DeNugent, Veronica Clark, Susan Lindauer, and Tracy Twyman. We'll be right back. More is coming up with Kai Murrows. Thank you for staying with us. RedIceMembers.com is the website.